Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Those gone birds are, they surround me, and I think about them constantly, and I can't help but think about them in the context of my South and our South and culture here. And so I know that at some point in time on the landscape that enslaved peoples were working and changing and trying to survive on, that people depended on these birds maybe for food at times, but they also may have depended on these birds for inspiration, that looking up from whatever toil, whatever chains bound you, that you could look up and maybe see Carolina parakeets, a flock of green and gold birds squawking and talking to one another and being wishful that you had that same ability.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Listening to Drew Lanham is like standing in a field and hearing the sounds of nature wash over you. Lanham grew up in the country in South Carolina and fell in love with watching birds. Eventually, he turned that love into his career. He's now the Distinguished Professor of Wildlife Ecology at Clemson University, where he specializes in the study of birds that have gone extinct. His essay on the Carolina parakeet, which died out 101 years ago, is part of this year's Best American Essays collection. Drew is also African American, which makes him an uncommon figure in the bird-watching world. He has thought deeply about the connections between those parts of his life. Here's our conversation. Drew Lanham, one of the things I read about you was that at some point early in your life, you used to lay down on the ground and play dead to see if buzzards would come after you. Do I have that right?
You do. I did that. It was part of these daily explorations from my grandmother's place, from her ramshackle house at the home place, and there was this circuitous path that I would take to my parents' house that was really less than a quarter of a mile away across the pasture around this little dirt road. And I would go in the opposite direction sometimes down through the pasture and through the bottom by the creek. But in that pasture, there was this lane and oftentimes this pretty open area. And there would be turkey vultures and black vultures, buzzards as we called them, that would circle, and I would watch those birds, and I had seen them on dead things, and my father had told me that the buzzards could see extraordinarily well, and I even knew somehow at an early age that turkey vultures could smell dead things. And so I decided on a couple of occasions that I wanted to see them up close and I guess personal, because I would lie out arms outstretched, looking the best, doing the best imitation of dead that I could do. I don't think I stank like a dead thing, but at the very least I tried to look like something that a buzzard would be attracted to, that I would possibly be a meal. And so it worked on a couple of occasions. Yeah, I thought it did. You know, I saw these things getting closer. I could see more than I had ever seen of them. I kept in my head this warning from my grandmother that once those buzzards came down, that the first thing that they would do would be to peck my eyes out. And so I lost my nerve. When I could see buzzard eyes, I decided I wanted to keep my own eyes. I'd get up then, and the death ruse was over, and the buzzards were cheated out of an easy meal of chocolate boy.
That's great. And that was growing up down in Edgefield, South Carolina, which is kind of near Augusta, Georgia. And it sounds like, from what you described just now and from what other stuff I've read, that your family had a pretty big presence down there. How far back do you think your family goes to that area?
The stories and from what we can pull from the records that exist, it seems to about 1790 when an enslaved teenager named Harry was brought south from the mid-Atlantic up around this place now called Lanham, Maryland, that he was brought south by these two Lanham brothers, the men who owned him. So 1790, and he was about 13 years old from what we can gather. He was brought here because as you look at that region, the mid-Atlantic, in about the late 1780s, early 1790s, historically, we know that there were huge sell-offs of enslaved peoples as land was being burned up by tobacco, which really impoverishes the soil, and people were losing money, that lots of enslaved were shipped south. Many were shipped south to breeding plantations, adults were, and others were shipped south as chattel to do other things. And so Harry was supposedly shipped south with these young men to try cotton, and that story is a fantastical one in itself. It's a horrific one in ways, because you're a teenager, you're shipped south, and you really don't know where you're going. You're ripped from family, you're ripped from familiarity, and all of that to me is sort of this nightmare that one lives through millions of times in that period of chattel slavery. But then to have it connected directly to your person, to who you are, to the place that you grew up, lying out in the pasture pretending to be a buzzard, you know, you come forward a couple of hundred years and there you are. And so from the mid-Atlantic to Edgefield, South Carolina, but really from West Africa and Central Africa through whatever routes and that transatlantic slave trade to Edgefield, South Carolina, which is famous and infamous historically for many reasons, most of them not good in terms of my blackness and for black people, but somehow my family was able to persist, to survive enslavement, to persist, I think, heroically through that, come through, fight for this country in a couple of wars, and stress education in a way that comes forward even today. So Edgefield is home. It's the home place, but it has its tendrils, I suppose, that reach out to other places that kind of define who the Lanham family was and is.
Strom Thurmond was from Edgefield, right?
Oh yeah, old Strom.
And did your family have any dealings with him over the years that you knew about?
Oh yeah. Well, let me tell you, my first dealing with Senator Thurmond, with Governor Thurmond at one time, of course, Edgefield's the home of 10 governors. But my first dealings with him was in middle school, was in junior high, when I had gone through a beta club, a junior beta club initiation, and the costume that had been chosen for me in this initiation was I was to be one of the 10 little Indians. And so, and pushing the caveat first and foremost, and understanding now just how stereotyped and improper that was. But my mother took all this time. She crafted this costume in one night, really, that looked for all the world like buckskin. And my father gathered a couple of turkey feathers for me, and my mother crafted this yarn wig for me. And so I was the winner, one of the winners of this initiation costume contest. So A few weeks after that, I got my picture taken for the Aiken Standard, which was a big deal. And a couple of weeks later, I got this envelope that looked rather official, and it was from the office of Senator J. Strom Thurmond. And I still have the note that has scrawled across it, "Congratulations, Senator J. Strom Thurmond." Yeah, yeah, that was, and that's part of the conundrum of our South, I think. And just, man, so much of it, almost everything is literally black and white. But then there's this huge continuum that often lies between the black and white that becomes gray. And so when I try to explain to my friends from other places outside of the South and sort of the complexity of where we live and how much I love the ecology of the place, how much I love so many people here, but despise the politics by and large, you know, they say, well, man, why don't you leave? Why don't you and your family, why don't you find another place to be? And I always come back to this point of it being home, and that I think it's really important to try to make home better, and that if you don't make home better, nobody else will. And so that sort of convergence and those conundrums that exist within the convergences between somebody like Strom and my family, I think that serves to make us a very different sort of people. And I would contend, Tommy, that ultimately, I think the big strides in terms of race have to be made here at home in the South.
I think that's true. We're going to talk about all this stuff. We're going to come back to it several times, I think, during this conversation. But I also wanted to establish sort of your beginnings as a kind of person out in the natural world and somebody for whom that became your career and your life's work. What do you think it was that first attracted you to birds? What made birds special to you?
They flew. You know, I mean, they flew, and every bird that I saw, and as a little boy out in the fields and forests and creeks, and so watching them fly, it just enthralled me. It made me want to be able to do that, and so I spent a lot of time as a kid fashioning wings out of anything that I could fashion wings out of. You know, the biggest treat for me, the biggest find, the biggest get was a big cardboard box, you know, something like some appliance might come in. And if I had a box like that, after I had exhausted all of the possibilities of forts and caves and cubby holes, I could take that box and I could fashion wings out of it and take strings or whatever and attach them to my arms, and I could try to fly.
So you were kind of a young Icarus in the making, huh?
I was little brown Icarus, but you know, gravity always won. Man, I jumped from everything that I could jump from. I climbed trees and jumped from trees. I would climb up on these very tall step ladders that my father had, and I would jump off of those. I would jump off of stacks of hay, and you know, and all of that. I only broke my collarbone once, but that was the thing that even if for a moment there was just this momentary sense of being untethered from the bounds and the binding ties of gravity. And that to me made birds irresistible. And so to watch anything, to watch a vulture or buzzard soar, to watch a red-tailed hawk dive, to watch a swallow just sort of float through the air, to watch any bird fly gave me the sense that if I could become a bird, then I could go anywhere, that I would be unbound by gravity, by responsibility, by, you know, being a husky-sized person as I was and that I am, that if I could become a bird, that I would be free.
So I know when you went off to college, you had obviously this deep interest in this subject and had built up some expertise or at least did a lot of reading and research. But when you went to college, you at first you decided not to study all this. Why was that?
Expectations, man. Those, you know, really, it was. I had plans to study it, but others had plans that they thought were better for me. And by
others, you mean like your family or like guidance counselors?
Well, my family in part, guidance counselors, almost everyone. I mean, hardly anyone beyond me and a friend knew what an ornithologist was. And when I told people that I wanted to major in wildlife biology or in forestry or zoology, they always came back with, well, why do you want to be a zookeeper? Why do you want to be a forest ranger? What's an ornithologist? And my father died in 1981. I was a senior in high school in 1983, and I had decided sometime between my graduating and my father's death that I wanted to be as self-sufficient as possible. And so when this tremendous scholarship fell my way from DuPont, they were only giving four of these full ride scholarships out a year to any college or university in the United States. If you majored in engineering, it was an offer that was, I guess, that was hard to refuse, even though I tried. I tried other avenues of finding money. I didn't want my mother burdened with college tuition because I just knew that things weren't easy beyond my father's death. I mean, we were not able to farm like we had. My mother was a school teacher, and I knew that there wasn't a lot of money there to be had. So I could only get portions of money to think about majoring in some life science. And so engineering sort of became a way for me to go to school, eventually to Clemson, and not have my mother burdened, and to please everybody else who said, well, if you really, really like birds, you can make a lot of money as an engineer because you're smart in math and science. You can get a job anywhere doing this engineering stuff, and then you can watch birds in your spare time.
Well, I'm always interested in these turning points in people's lives. So could you sort of talk about and describe the moment when you decided to give that engineering life up and follow your dream?
Yeah, it was spring semester, I believe, 1985, and I'd been pretty successful in engineering. I mean, I wasn't doing badly. I'd had friends and associates and other people who'd sort of washed through, who had decided that other things were for them. But I had hung on. I had done well enough to keep my scholarship. I'd even made the dean's list once. But it was torture. Every summer I would go and I would work at what my father used to call the bum plant. But the Savannah River site, and man, they were paying me a lot of money to do this alleged engineering stuff. And I hated it. I would go into that place, and every day I had this calendar above my desk, and I would mark the days from day one until the end of the summer when I would be done with that. And so that kind of torture on that spring day sort of all came to this culmination of walking to class. I'm headed to class, had been thinking for so long about how I could do other things. And so that morning, I was walking to an early class. I think it was a 9:05 class. And I got to this corner next to this place called Redfern. It's our health center here on campus. And I just stopped in my tracks. I stopped in my tracks. And I turned around and I went back to my room and drew the blinds, dropped the blinds, closed them, got a big bowl of Fruit Loops, watched cartoons in the half dark for most of that day, trying to figure out what it was that I was going to do. Was I going to go to class again the next day? And I didn't. I told my girlfriend, the woman who had become my wife, I told her, I said, I can't do this. I called my scholarship sponsor again and begged, and they said, well, you know, you're going to lose your scholarship if you try to make a change. I called my mother, and she said, all you got to do is finish, just finished. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't go back. I was sorely desperate and to be free, to fly free of these bindings of expectation that everybody had for me. And I remember people telling me again and again and again that the things that I wanted to do, being an ornithologist, being a zoologist, that these weren't things that Black people did. And so until I became strong enough in myself to say, you know what, this is who I am. This is who I want and need to be. That corner, that spring day, going to that class, turning at that corner, turning around and going back to my room and having the courage to say, no, I'm going to be who Drew wants Drew to be and not who you want Drew to be. That was the turning point in my life.
When we come back, Drew Lanham talks about his rules for being a Black bird watcher and how he's had to follow those rules in his own life. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org, or you can tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. It will really help if you subscribe to the NPR One app and listen to Southbound there. That lets NPR know directly that you're out there listening. Thank you for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Drew Lanham. I know that one of your passions in this field has been what you call gone birds, birds that are extinct or presumed to be extinct. And I've heard that your office, in some ways, is sort of a tribute to those birds. Could you sort of describe what that looks like?
Wow. Yeah, it's... for some people who would walk into my office and who knew birds, they might think it's a little morose, but you walk in, the first thing that you're going to see is above my desk is this huge portrait of a pair of ivory-billed woodpeckers, the Lord God bird.
Right.
There they are, you know, sort of forever posed in this grub-seeking frenzy that ivory bills would be involved in, those enormous beaks of theirs being used as wedges in this live oak. And right next to them is a painting, an Ann Worsham Richardson painting of passenger pigeons, once one of the most abundant birds on earth. But as my friend Joel Greenberg wrote, that's a story of birds going from billions to none. And next to that is a portrait of Bachman's Warbler, always probably a sort of rare bird, but a bird that was named after one of the preeminent ornithologists here in South Carolina, Reverend Bachman. But then from there, it was a bird that was just hard to locate. And then next to that is this figure of a Carolina parakeet, and that Carolina parakeet was fashioned out of ingeniously fashioned out of pipe cleaners by a friend of mine, Tiffany Adams, who thought enough of me to send me this bird that she knew I was obsessed with. And so all of these birds, and there's a 3D printed skull of a great auk that a friend gave me, and there's a small portrait of a Labrador duck. So yeah, all these gone birds surround me, and it's a reminder to me of sort of the sins of our past, because these are all birds that we had a great deal to do with their goneness, that they are extinct in part because we were careless and uncaring enough to push them either to the verge of disappearing forever, or we outright obliterated them because of our greed and sort of selfish sense of nature being something that we should control. So those gone birds are, they surround me, and I think about them constantly. And I, you know, I can't help but think about them in the context of my South and our South and culture here. And so I know that at some point in time on the landscape that enslaved peoples were working and changing and trying to survive on, that people depended on these birds maybe for food at times, but they also may have depended on these birds for inspiration, that looking up from whatever toil, whatever chains bound you, that you could look up and maybe see Carolina parakeets, a flock of green and gold birds squawking and talking to one another and being wishful that you had that same ability. You know, I think about Harriet Tubman as a birder, and I think about Harriet Tubman hearing Lord God birds and knowing that that must have come from deep forests and swamps where slave catchers probably would not pursue, or maybe that it was easier to lose harrying hounds in those kinds of places. So I try to put those gone birds in the context of the past and what we've done to make them disappear. But I also try to keep in mind that people before me, people who looked like me, may have had those birds in their hearts somehow, in their hearts and minds, and in their bodies, quite honestly. And so they are important to me. They are very important to me.
I want to come back to that in just a second, but I want to ask one quick question as just a fellow person with hope. I grew up down the Ottumwa River in Georgia, which is one of the places where occasionally somebody will claim to have spotted the Lord God bird, the ivory bill, even though I guess it supposedly has been extinct for many decades now. I wonder whether, when you're out in the woods, especially out in the swamp or somewhere like that, if you ever think, maybe today, if I've been living right, maybe something like that will show up in front of me.
Man, that's the that's the dream I've had since I was a kid. And since I knew what ivory-billed woodpeckers and Carolina parakeets and Bachman's warblers and passenger pigeons were, that, yeah, sometimes I'm out and I still, that somehow I would be graced with a living ghost somehow, you know, to see something that would cause me to question reality, but then to confirm hope. And for me, that's a large part of it. I will tell people as they ask me about the existence of ivory bills, I don't deny their existence. I don't deny the possibility of their existence. Now, the probabilities are, that's a different thing. But possibility always holds out hope. Probability is a statistic. And so I, as a scientist, I deal in probabilities and confidence intervals. As a human being, I deal in hope in ways that, yeah, if I'm in a place that's, as James Kilgoe says, is deep enough for ivory bills, that there's some possibility, that there's some remote possibility there that these beings still exist. And so I think in part that's maybe, I don't know, maybe part of my grandmother Mamatha coming back through me and the ghost that she used to talk to nightly. Maybe I just want to talk to a different kind of ghost.
You came up at one point, I've seen sort of, I think, written versions and maybe a video version of this, of rules for a black birder. Could you sort of explain what some of those are and why you felt like you needed to create them?
You know, that again is life for me. Birds have become really much more than allegory, much more than metaphor. They are real facets of my life that are important. And so as a black bird watcher, there are things that I've thought about that many of us, those of us who happen to be black or of color and watch birds or study nature, that we've encountered. And so when I was asked to write that piece for Orion magazine and this section called Enumeration, I remember the poetry editor asking me, well, do you think you could come up with something in a couple of weeks? And as I was sitting there, I was thinking, yeah, a couple of weeks, sure. And it was less than 2 hours later, I was sending them the draft of this thing. And I could send that quickly. I could write it that quickly because I had thought about all of them. I'd like to think I have a little bit of a sense of humor, certainly sarcastic wit. And so some of that came across that way when at that point in time we were dealing with the shooting in Florida of Trayvon and there were conversations about hoodies, about a piece of clothing and what that meant. And people were protesting in hoodies. And I was thinking about being out at night or on the edge of night as a birder and what I could wear, should wear, shouldn't wear, and how I might be mistaken for someone who wasn't birding, not because I shouldn't be birding, but because of who I am, the color of my skin. So thinking about something like a hoodie or thinking about being mistaken for the other black birder, or
the other,
well, there's more than two of us, but still in having sort of this idea of your rarity as an observer being akin to being a rare bird. And so all of that came pretty easy for me to think about. Was talking to a friend last week through a radio broadcast, and as we were talking, he mentioned his father buying him a pair of green binoculars instead of a pair of black binoculars. And he said, as an afterthought, he wondered, you know, would people seeing me in half light with black binoculars, this black metallic object, me pulling that out of a coat or from a pocket, would they think otherwise? Would they think that I was handling some other sort of object that might be mistaken and have me harmed as opposed to me pulling out this pair of green binoculars? So all of those are sorts of things that birds bring to our consciousness. I talk a lot about range maps. I talk a lot about, and Nine Rules for the Black Birder was sort of my stake in that ground, I think, to help people understand maybe who aren't black or of color to think about what things limit where they go or how they do what they do or how they live. You know, if you're living in a place that doesn't allow you to love who you want to love, whom you want to love, or marry whom you want to marry, then maybe you will fly to some other space that allows you to seek your mate as you would choose to seek your mate. And that's a range change. That's a big deal. And it's no less than birds flying from one place to another to find suitable habitat away from unsuitable circumstances. So Nine Rules was sort of, for me, it was big because it gave me a chance to express in words as a writer and as a poet, to express in words what birds mean and can mean in a person's life beyond just watching them, beyond just counting them, beyond just listing them.
Well, I do wonder, you know, you framed it metaphorically really beautifully, but I did wonder on a practical level, have you had kind of bad experiences out in the field?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I have. I, you know, it's, you know, my whole dissertation career was changed in part because there was a group of white nationalists and separatists that set up camp very close to my research sites. And it frightened me to the point of abandoning that research project, a funded research project, during the early stages of my doctoral studies. And I had to find another project. That was a big deal. That was a huge range change for me. And so those sorts of things lead you to be, again, on a different sort of alert.
I just want to kind of finish up by coming back to this idea of hope that you talked about a little while ago. I know you've said explicitly kind of this idea of that Emily Dickinson poem, that hope is the thing with feathers. And that's obviously a really explicit link to kind of your life's work. I just wonder how you see that both kind of in your mind and out in the world.
For me, it goes back to this idea of probability and possibility. For me, hope is possibility. You know, it's all those things that lie out there before us that for the good of birds and people can happen. So I always hold out hope. I hold out hope for better between people. I hold out hope for a better world for birds. I hold out hope that we'll be able to connect those dots between humans and non-humans. And I can't mention hope without mentioning love. And so if it's okay, I kind of have it in a poem. Would it be okay if I read that?
Absolutely.
This is called Love for a Song. We are enamored with the quest for unconditionally reciprocated love. The idea of some measure of affection given back for what is doled out. The barter, bits of affection for pieces of adoration. It is, I think, what we all need. We crave the meadowlark's ringing song, desire the greening of spring from our sun-starved souls down to our bare-toed roots. We seek the winding path and wander until we find the sweet spots. Blackwater cypress swamp, tall grass prairie sweep, the place where moonlight glancing off of tide-slicked stones made us weep. We look for measures of love, and some forest-dwelling thrush heaps it on us in self-harmonizing sonata. Marvel, then, at the migratory sojourns of birds. Revel in the blooming expanses of wildflowers. Sink your heart deep into the rhythm of buzzing bees. Find hope in the relieved canopies of the tallest trees. Wind and water, storm and surf, they all can move us to other ends. Therein is the turn-on, the honey-sweet seduction. Nature asks only that we notice a sunrise here, a sunset there. The surge, that overwhelming, inexplicable thing in a swallow's joyous flight, or the dawning of new light that melds heart and head into sensual soul in that moment of truly seeing. That is love. And for me, that's hope.
I don't have much more to add this week, just two suggestions. One, go read Drew Lanham's stories and poems. And two, wherever you are, go outside and watch the birds. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.